It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rigger.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get the latest on an emerging market, wearable technology.
But first, a botched lethal injection in Oklahoma has brought the issue of capital punishment in the United States into the international spotlight. The execution gone wrong has people around the world talking about the methods used for capital punishment, as well as the constitutionality of the death penalty.
Megan Ryan is with us to help sort out these issues. She's assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start by getting up to speed on what happened there in Oklahoma. What went wrong?
Well, Clayton Lockett was convicted of shooting a 19-year-old woman and watching his two accomplices bury her alive. And as a result, he was sentenced to death. And as they were trying to execute him, after they had administered the first drug in their cocktail for lethal injection, he was declared unconscious. But a few minutes later, he was observed writhing, clenching his teeth, breathing heavily. At that time, the blinds were closed so that observers could not really see what happened after that. Officials called a halt to the proceedings, but he shortly thereafter died of a heart attack.
Now, this was Oklahoma's first time using a new combination of three different drugs for an execution. How do these drugs get tested before they're used for a real execution? Obviously, you can't test them on human subjects.
That's right. It's obviously problematic from an ethical standpoint to test lethal injection drugs on humans. And as a result, there isn't really a great way to test them on humans. And it's difficult because humans vary their compositions, how heavy they are, how their body might react to things differ from person to person. So it's very difficult to predict what the effect of these drugs will be exactly in each individual. An additional problem related to that is doctors, having taken the Hippocratic Oath, generally do not want to be involved with killing people, which would be causing harm to them. And therefore, there's not a great resource in terms of getting some advice as to what the effects of these drugs might be. And another problem is states keep much of this information related to their lethal injection protocols secret, and therefore it's difficult for outsiders to act as watchdogs and see whether appropriate precautions are being taken place.
And this is against a backdrop where there were drugs, I gather, that states and the federal government had been using them, and the supply is going away. Why is that?
Well, you're right. A few years back, a lot of states used a very similar lethal injection cocktail, a three-drug cocktail consisting of sodium pentothal, pancuronium bromide, and potassium chloride. Many of these drugs, or a good quantity especially of the sodium pentothal, were sold by European countries to the United States, to the various states and departments of corrections. But many European countries now are opposed to capital punishment, and they've put a stop to states using these drugs for the purpose of putting people to death. And that's how this shortage in drugs for lethal injection has arisen.
And then in your state of Texas, there's been, I gather, controversy about some secrecy about where lethal injection drugs are coming from.
That's true. Texas is the capital of capital punishment, really. And one strategy that states have resorted to, including Texas, is obtaining drugs from what's known as compounding pharmacies. Compounding pharmacies are pharmacies over which there is not as much oversight as there would be over a traditional manufacturer, and they are generally used to customize drugs to particular individuals. And Texas has been not wanted to release information as to which compounding facilities are providing drugs for lethal execution. And that has some people up in arms because, again, there's no way for watchdogs or people to watch over the situation and make sure the appropriate precautions are taking place, making sure that the drugs are being tested properly to make sure they actually are the right drugs, that no shortcuts are being taken that would make them not exactly what they're supposed to be using in lethal injection.
There's been debate over time about cruel and unusual punishment as related to the death penalty. Opponents of the death penalty say it's inherently cruel and unusual. Supporters say it isn't, but if there is undue suffering in the process, then it can be. When did we end up with lethal injection as the being perceived as the least cruel and unusual form of capital punishment?
Well, capital punishment has certainly evolved over the years, originally hanging, then it was thought that electrocution was more humane, and then now we're in an age of lethal injection, of course, which most everyone thinks is more humane. But it's really difficult to know what sort of pain people are actually going through as they're being put to death. One aspect of lethal injection that might suggest that it's more humane in some sense is we don't see the sort of suffering that you do with respect to, for example, electrocution, right? You don't see someone essentially frying. And so it's more palatable from an observer standpoint. But we don't really know what it feels like to the person who's being put to death.
And part of the move away from things like especially public hanging, we've moved away from the idea of capital punishment over the long haul as a public spectacle. And now it's a very private event, maybe with a few witnesses. What led to that?
I think just social forces really led to this movement from executions being used as a deterrent and being used as entertainment, really, in early America up until, I think, 1834. Pennsylvania was the last state to move executions away from the public eye. And some people think that this is greater, upholds the dignity of the offender in a better way because people aren't laughing, or people aren't watching it for entertainment value. Other people think that this might be one of the reasons that capital punishment has continued to exist because we no longer have to actually watch a person being put to death in most circumstances. And even as we see in the Oklahoma case, the prison officials closed the blinds so people could not see the Clayton Lockett writhing about because it's very unpalatable to view that. So this movement from public executions to private executions has two effects, really. The effect of perhaps making execution more palatable in some sense to many people because we don't really see it, and the other effect of possibly, on the other side of the coin, upholding an offender's dignity in dying.
We're talking to Megan Ryan, a professor of law at Southern Methodist University, talking about capital punishment and its future, especially in light of the botched execution this week in Oklahoma.
And we want to hear from you on this issue. What do you think about capital punishment? What's your reaction to what happened in Oklahoma? Should we abolish capital punishment in the United States, or do you think it's necessary? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our discussion on capital punishment now with Megan Ryan, professor of law at Southern Methodist University.
It's in the news lately after the botched execution in Oklahoma. It has a lot of people talking about the methods of capital punishment. What do you think? What do you think about what happened in Oklahoma? Do you support or oppose the death penalty? Should it be abolished in the United States? Or would you like to see it here in Wisconsin? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org. Go right to a caller. We've got Steve on the line in Monaco. Steve, hi.
Hi. The relatively short period of time that this vicious criminal suffered is nothing in comparison to the years that the family of the victim suffered, waiting and wondering if this vicious sewer rat was going to get out and do the same thing to somebody else. There's no rehabilitating these type of people that don't have a conscience. And I'm wondering why the media presents us all like we're supposed to feel sorry for this person, and many of the stories don't even mention the victim and what she went through. It's nothing. It's trivial in comparison to the hurt that he and many other people like him caused to the civilized people of society. I mean, when President McKinley was shot, Edison took a video of that, and people have seen that since. I mean, to see the guy get fried, it was instant justice. And I feel bad that we gave this creep free room and board for 10 years.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Megan, that's a common argument. You mentioned earlier the crime, shooting the victim and then watching as his friends buried her alive. Why should we be concerned that this person is dead and that he suffered for a few minutes along the way?
That's a great question, and thank you, Steve, for bringing it up. The problem here is that under the Constitution, in particular the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, the Supreme Court has said that it's unconstitutional to allow someone to suffer beyond what's necessary to actually put them to death. The idea of someone deserving a punishment, and certainly people on death row, many have oftentimes done terrible crimes, murdered people, buried them alive, and do deserve punishment. The state, of course, has said that they deserve the death penalty, the worst punishment that is allowed under the law in the United States. But the Supreme Court has said, and even the founders, those who wrote the Constitution, have always said that torture is unconstitutional. So the question is, where is that line drawn? At what time does something amount to torture? And these prohibitions that we see in the Eighth Amendment is thought to not only protect individual offenders, but also protect the public from devolving into a society that acts in an inhumane way. So while certainly it's understandable for people to have this passionate response suggesting that people who are on death row deserve to die, from a legal perspective, we've taken the position that we are not going to allow people to be punished with passion. It should be a dispassionate process and one governed by the law. And the law says that it's unconstitutional once you go beyond the amount of pain necessary to cause death.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Don with us in Winchester. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the program today. I'm just kind of stunned by the guy who just called that said it's no big deal that the person in Oklahoma suffered for 40-some minutes before he died because he made other people suffer. You know, I would, first of all, I'm absolutely opposed to capital punishment. I'm glad that Wisconsin does not have it. And I would be, well, I can't say for certain, obviously, but it's amazing to me that there are so many quote-unquote Christians that talk about the fact that they are 100% for capital punishment, and I wouldn't be surprised if that guy who was just talking also happened to be Christian. I just don't get the hypocrisy there. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Don, thanks for the call. Megan, he's voicing opposition to the death penalty. Is this case in Oklahoma something that's lending fire to the anti-death penalty cause, do you think?
I certainly think that the botched execution in Oklahoma is lending fire to the abolition movement. There's been a strong abolition movement in the United States for a long time, but it's an issue that really polarizes people. I'm coming out of Texas here, so the sentiment expressed by the first caller, Steve, is very common in Texas, where capital punishment is very prominent compared to other states. But I certainly understand the other position that there is some sort of conflict, perhaps, with some people's religious views and then their political views as to the appropriateness of capital punishment.
I want to wrap up, Megan, by looking to the future. Is there a concern for people who support capital punishment that if they can't deal with this lethal injection situation, guarantee that there isn't this additional suffering beyond that necessary to cause death, that there could be a real constitutional problem with continuing capital punishment?
That's a difficult question. There's significant support for capital punishment in the United States. Depending upon how the question is asked, poll numbers suggest that it's divided about 50-50, the number of people who support capital punishment and those that oppose it. Capital punishment is contemplated in the language of the Constitution, so there's a significant hurdle for the court to declare that it's unconstitutional. But the Supreme Court continues to be chipping away at the death penalty, and perhaps this could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Currently, courts have been hesitant to require departments of corrections and states to disclose information related to their lethal injection protocols, which makes it very difficult for people to challenge the constitutionality of those lethal injection protocols. But the Supreme Court has said that certainly pain is going to be involved if you're putting people to death, and the Supreme Court has been very clear that capital punishment itself is constitutional. So I think it's going to be a little while before something just like this causes the Supreme Court to find it an unconstitutional punishment.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Megan Ryan, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
Coming up after the news, our guest futurist fills us in on the new tech gadgets that could transform our lives, including socks that help improve your running technique.
If you support this kind of programming on important issues and then on interesting issues like technology, make your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Stick around.
Our next guest keeps close tabs on the world of technology. She's an economist, author, and futurist, and the founder and co-owner of Next Generation Consulting. She joins us now to talk about emerging trends in wearable technology and where the industry is headed next. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
It is so great to be here. Happy, happy hour.
That's right. Getting to be that time. Well, there's so much cool stuff to talk about in the world of wearable technology. But let's get our terminology straight. What are we talking about when we talk about wearable technology?
Okay, so it's technology you can wear.
What?
Yeah, I know. Crazy. So the most pedestrian example of this is like a standard watch, right? I mean, we don't wear Stonehenge on our wrists. We don't wear Big Ben or a giant replica. We wear a tiny little device, probably powered by a battery, that's a little more convenient. It's a very pedestrian example of wearable tech.
But it goes way off from there. Ooh. I mean, that's sort of, you know, the beginning grounds of it. But something that people are sort of familiar with already in terms of wearable technology is something like Nike's Fuel Band. And this is giving athletes information, syncing with their bodies, things like that. But tell us about that and then sort of the new iteration, something called Jaybird Rain.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was not a Fuel Band person or a Fitbit person, although I know a lot of my girlfriends like to tuck that little guy in their bra. I was a Jawband Up person. And I love this thing, right? So you plug it into your phone, it measures your sleep, it tells you how good your sleep was, if you didn't already know by how tired you were. It measured all your steps, you could tell it when you were playing tennis and whatnot. Well, the Rain picks up where all those devices left off. For one thing, it has the most gorgeous app on your smartphone. It attaches wirelessly, you never have to plug anything in, and you don't have to tell it when you're exercising. Like, it knows the difference between if you're in the pool swimming versus when you're running. You don't even have to tell, say, I was swimming or I was biking. It knows.
Based on your body motion somehow.
I know. So all of these gyroscopes that are in these wearables are mind-blowing.
Wow, that's really cool. And it tells you that one, I think, when you need a nap.
I know. So imagine you wake up and you already know you had a bad night of sleep, right? So at maybe 1:30 in the afternoon, it'll be like, Veronica, maybe now's the time, right, to lay down for 30 minutes. So it's fab.
I wonder if that would work at work. I could go to my boss and say, look, my Rain says here I need a nap. It's beautiful.
Worth a try.
It's worth a try. Well, one area that smart tech, wearable tech is marketed to is the prosumer. This is professional consumers. What kinds of gadgets are we seeing there for that group?
Yeah, so these sort of hypro-glow consumers. So the two examples I like are from athletics, right? So I don't know if you're a runner. I used to be. I don't like it so much anymore. Hard on the joints.
I'm runner in quotes and italics.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I'm working on it.
Okay. A runner wannabe.
Right.
So you could buy these socks, right, that will tell you, will measure your foot strike and whether, like, you pronate and what you could do to, like, improve your running dynamics. That's amazing. But my favorite one in the prosumer category is the D-shirt. Clever, right? Rhymes with T-shirt.
Oh, D-shirt.
D-shirt stands for digital shirt. And it's embedded with all this technology. They're being used by athletes and coaches because when an athlete is like maxing their O2 level or their respiration's really high, coaches could know, I need to sub Veronica now. She's like at her max.
Oh, it sounds healthy for athletes. They might not want to be pulled out at that crucial stage in the game, but probably good to know health-wise.
Yeah, health-wise and from the team performance perspective, right? So you want to have fresh players in who maybe aren't maxed.
Now, another area, so that's sort of the sports arena, and, you know, parents. Parents are always a hot market. What do we have going for parents in wearable tech?
Well, in January, there's this big geek convention that happens in Las Vegas called CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and Intel's booth this year was swarmed by people who were looking at this smart onesie.
I'm sorry that the term smart onesie.
I know.
Anything with onesie, really. But anyway, tell me about the smart onesie.
Exactly. So it will not, it has no relationship to any diapering. I just want to point that out immediately.
Okay.
What it is really a baby monitor on steroids. So it can tell your baby's temperature. It can tell your baby's respiration. So parents who are, especially first-time parents who get twitchy maybe about sudden infant death syndrome, right on your smartphone, you will be able to read your baby's, deets. So
Wow. That's
pretty intense.
How much does a smart onesie cost?
I think they're going for $29.99, but I may be wrong. Okay, listeners, she just gave me like the hairy eyeball, like that cannot be right. So it might not be right, but check it. Just Google Smart Onesie by Intel, you'll find it.
That's really interesting. Okay, and there was an item that you mentioned earlier that has gotten a ton of buzz. It is called the Ring.
The Ring.
What is the Ring?
So as you might imagine, it's a ring. And again, this ring is jammed with so much gyroscope technology. You wear it on your index finger. And out of the box, it knows some gestures. So for example, if I would put that ring on my index finger and draw in the air the icon of a light bulb, that would know, oh my goodness, Rebecca wants to do something with her lights. So then I could dial it counterclockwise or clockwise to dial my lights down or up if they were on a dimmer. So super cool.
Okay, that's sort of cool, but isn't that sort of like a glorified clapper? What else does it do?
Oh, Veronica, a glorified clapper.
Well,
here are some other things it does. Here are some other things it does. You can program it to coordinate with your bank and your wallet. So when you go to Gray's this afternoon or to the restaurant of your choice, you can take that bill. You can do a couple taps on your ring to indicate now you're in the financial space. You can add the tip by drawing the dollar amount and the tip amount. And then you swipe to the left to say, it is now complete.
In the air.
In the air.
You're swiping in the air with your finger.
Yeah. Yes, you are like drawing stuff in the air with your finger.
So are people going to think this is sort of like the Google Glass thing, right? Where people call them, never mind, I can't say that on the air, where people call them bad names because they look like they're not quite interacting with society. They're in their own little world. And if you've got all these people swooping around with their fingers in the air,
yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, I personally really like it because I think it's a safety feature. So like one of the things that too many people do is text while driving. And if you don't have to look down at your phone and interact with a keyboard and you can just text something in the air while you're driving, that seems a little bit safer to me. So yeah, you might look like a giant geek, but if you're geeky enough, you're going to love the ring.
All right. What is it, pretty?
It's not bad. It's like, it's the one, the demo I saw was like a big gold chunky ring. It's a little blingy, actually.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this could be something people are interested in. We're going to move to the fashion realm next. You know, fashion has to be part of this. What do we know about what's changing with wearable tech there?
Well, let me ask you, when you were young, did your mother ever say, Veronica, stop staring?
I guess so. I think probably I got mad when
so
people stared.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
staring
know.
Seems rude, right? But
yeah.
There is a designer who has Ying Gao, and she's designed a dress that when you stare at the dress long enough, the fibers on the dress move. So this is all based on retina technology, which it is super cool.
So the fibers on the dress move. Do they mm-hmm. change color or is it just like the dress is sort of undulating?
I haven't seen them change color, but they do move. So it's like the fabric has a little motion to it. These wisps of fabric are very lightweight, but it's a piece of art.
Wow. Would you wear that?
I'm not a dress wearer so much, but if it came in a smart slack, I might be right up in there.
Smart slack. You have to work on your name first.
Okay.
All right. Well, what about something like a T-shirt? I've heard that there are really cool things happening with T-shirts and musical instruments.
Yeah. So I almost ordered one of these for us, but I wasn't sure if we would be coordinated to do enough to do the demo. But basically, it's a T-shirt by ThinkGeek, and it comes in two versions. One is a guitar. So the guitar is printed on the shirt, and you can actually strum the strings and play the frets. The other one is a drum kit. So this is for your inner music geek. This is the shirt for you.
Now that is cool. Yeah, so you can play your T-shirt.
I'll bring you one the next time.
Wow. Can you play, you know, actual tunes, or is it just a random?
No, you can play. So the video that you can see, if you go to the Think Geek website, they've done a little YouTube video, and it actually shows the drum kit and the guitarist playing with a real guitarist.
Wow, that is amazing. So, Rebecca, you've told us about this new crop. You know, in our next 30 seconds or so, what is coming up? What is the next mind-bendy stuff we should be looking forward to?
Yeah, so, you know, these sensors are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and the big word for that is nanotech. And one of the things I'm really excited about is Google has invented a contact lens that measures blood glucose levels. So for diabetics, that's going to be a game changer.
Oh, right. So instead of having to draw blood right on your eye, yeah, that you're right. That's a game changer right there. Well, so lots of exciting things to look forward to. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming by and filling us in on what's happening.
My pleasure. I'm bringing you a T-shirt next time. Look out.
All right. That sounds pretty cool for people to look at. Rebecca Ryan, an economist, author, and futurist. She's the founder and co-owner of Next Generation Consulting.